First case this morning is United States v. Gonzalez. Is the appellant prepared to argue? The government? Appellant may argue.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Captain Steve Dre, and along with Major Julie Borchers, I represent the appellant, Specialist Michael Gonzalez. The military judge erred when he found the appellant guilty of aggravated sexual contact with a child as a lesser-included offense of rape of a child. The military judge's finding fails to meet either prong of this court's...
Could you speak up a little?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
The military judge's finding fails to meet either prong of this court's two-part elements test. First, elements of aggravated sexual contact with a child are not necessarily included in the elements of rape of a child. And second, that the language of specification 1 of charge 2 does not allege facts sufficient to state all of the elements of both offenses. Simply put, aggravated sexual contact with a child requires the government to prove a specific intent that the accused had a specific intent to gratify the sexual desires, abuse, humiliate, or harass, or degrade another person. The Supreme Court explicitly moved beyond the approach the government advocates here in 1989 when it moved away from the inherent relationship test to this elements test. It requires an examination of the elements from an objective viewpoint as opposed to using a subjective analysis.
Well, objective or subjective, is it possible to conceive of a factual situation in which the penis touches the vulva without some sort of sexual desire? I wish I knew how, but I'm at a loss.
Well, Your Honor, you said touches the vulva there, and I would
say... As I understand, no penetration was proven.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right.
Well, essentially, so, that is the only interpretation to take from this
right.
finding.
So go ahead.
Right, so here, and this goes to the prejudice, Your Honor, but this incident, as AP alleged, it was a single incident that happened in the shower. She testified that it occurred when she was 3 or 4 years old, a small child, that she was in there with her biological father in the shower. She testified many years after the incident, 5 years after this incident occurred, about this. And so there could have been a situation where the appellant was touching a small, wriggling child in the shower who didn't want to be in the shower and was trying to finish that situation, and then there was some kind of touching that occurred. Whereas here there is absolutely no defense to a penetration, which is what the government charged here. And so they essentially got to charge something that put the appellant into a corner where he could not argue, put on any evidence that anything happened other than AP was fabricating some part of this story, that she was either repeating something that somebody else told her about the penetration or simply was lying for some reason. Whereas
now you said that the accused couldn't put on any other evidence. What about the government's position that, let's refer to it as the shower incident, that there was also the charge of the sexual touching that requires specific intent to gratify sexual desire? So how did that affect how the accused would approach this whole incident in the shower?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that the government's argument there emphasizes the predicament that the appellant is in with this, that when the government charges a penetrative offense, he cannot reasonably stand up and say, well, she simply misinterpreted this offense, the specification 5, but that she's just lying about the penetration. And so when the government controls the charge sheet and puts that specification on there, he's limited to establishing that the entire situation was some type of fabrication and would have had to prepare for trial in that manner.
So the very fact that one is a general intent and one is a specific intent crime boxes in an accused. Is that
Yes, Your Honor. And four circuits have agreed with...
What about the fact that there were other specific intent offenses on the table? I mean, he was charged with other specific intent offenses on the same charge sheet revolving around the same incident, right?
Yes, Your Honor. That's specification five.
And so, I mean, would you disagree that there was at least some notice that he had to defend against this notion that there was a specific intent to gratify sexual desires?
Some notice, Your Honor, but again, the manner in which the government charged this was over almost a year period, and it's not manifestly clear from the charge sheet that this was one single discrete event, and AP's testimony and story changed, and so the defense had to prepare for each charge. And again, because this charge was on the charge sheet, it boxed him in terms of...
Well, the government has no duty to make it easy on the accused.
Certainly not, Your Honor.
I mean, you seem to be sort of standing up here and complaining, well, they boxed him in and they did that and they did that.
Perhaps.
Well, so what? Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. The so what is that then the government can do that. The government has many advantages in the charging decisions. They then shouldn't get the advantage of getting a conviction for a lesser included offense that is not necessarily included within the charge.
So, but counsel, this is, I think, a slightly different point, which is I can agree with you, right, that you can't have something be an LIO if it has a greater mens rea. That doesn't answer the separate question of the prejudice, right, which is what possible defense, even if it had been charged separately, right, could he have had that he didn't have? Like if he'd known, if it had been written on the charge sheet, what defense could he have had?
For this lesser included offense?
Yes.
That she misinterpreted what happened in the shower, that she was a young child, that she was three.
Wasn't that what he said anyway? She misinterpreted it. It didn't happen. It was made up. Right?
Well,
I
think there's a subtle but important distinction between made up and misremembered. When the government's expert testified about the malleability of children's memories, and you have this very young girl testifying many years later about something that happened, and that difference between her being penetrated, which implies...
But he was found not guilty of penetrating.
Yes, Your Honor, but again, had that charge not been the reality with which he was faced, and the government had charged in the alternative, then he could have prepared a different defense to address that defense. But they didn't. The government charged him with an offense that there was one defense to.
So, counsel, the whole point here is the issue of notice, having adequate notice to be able to know what to defend against. So, in the manual, it listed, from your point of view, incorrectly, as an LIO of rape of the child, the aggravated sexual contact. So, why, based on that very fact, that it was listed right there in black and white, that it was a lesser included offense, why couldn't that be perceived as being notice that something that the accused needed to defend against at court martial?
Because this court has said that those lesser included offenses are not controlling, so...
No, and I understand that, but that's an altogether different issue. What I'm saying is, notice going into court martial. If the accused and his counsel did not say to the judge, military judge going in, hey, the manual lists aggravated sexual contact as being a lesser included offense, but that's wrong. But they didn't. So based on what the black and white manual said, like I said, I understand fully that you're saying that that was incorrect and that this court should not rely on it. I'm simply focusing narrowly on the issue of notice. Did that provide notice?
No, Your Honor, for two reasons. First, I would dispute the notion that an accused has the burden to before any discussion, assert that a purported lesser-included offense as listed in the manual is something that a military judge shouldn't consider. Here, strange facts where the military judge never discussed lesser-included offenses on the record, merely recessed the court.
Isn't the fact that once the military judge entered a finding of guilty, right, to a listed LIO, whether it's actually an LIO or not, isn't that some evidence that they weren't surprised, that they did have notice?
I don't think that's – I think –
Well, I mean, if I'm sitting there and the military judge says, all right, I'm not going to find you guilty of the charge offense, but I'm finding you guilty of this other thing. And I'm going, but it's not, you can't do that. It's not an LIO. I didn't know anything about this. I would expect that I would say something, right?
Perhaps if they were prepared for that, perhaps some evidence, but not dispositive here, Your Honor.
Counsel. Oh, I'm sorry. Please finish answering the question.
I just have one more point for Judge Olson, if that's okay. The second out is just the discussion of the manual admonishes trial counsel to be wary of lesser-included offense and make charging decisions based on that. And so I would just, as to notice, the defense is on notice of that admonishment just as much as trial counsel is. And again, the burden is on the trial counsel to properly craft charges, Your Honor.
Yeah, sorry. Counsel, can you address the Eighth Circuit's decision in the Damarius case that the government cites? That case says that, well, in general, a specific intent crime cannot be a lesser-included offense of a general intent crime. But with rape, it's a special situation because it's impossible to commit the penetrative offense without a sexual intent. And therefore, even though strictly speaking it's a general intent crime, it necessarily includes the same sexual intent that would be required for the lesser included offense.
Yes, Your Honor. So 2 points to that as well, if I may. First, the facts in Damarius and in the circuit court's opinion are not eminently clear, but I do believe that was a digital penetration, which under this court's reasoning, we would not be here. A digital penetration is different and does come with it that specific intent measure. I don't think that's how the Damarius court ruled. They did just conduct this analysis and say such a penetration cannot occur without a sexual intent. I'd say that's irrelevant, though. Without going into strange hypotheticals about why someone may penetrate a child's vulva with their penis, there could be another reason aside from gratifying sexual desires or abusing your degree. It could be something like curiosity. And the difference there is that Congress has clearly legislated that they do not care what the reason is, that the crime is perhaps so heinous and that it is complete at the act of penetration. And so then the specific intent is irrelevant.
So you suggest, is it your position then that in fact penetrative offense could occur without the intent?
Yes, Your
Honor. And I'm not talking about tripping and falling or something like that, but a notional penetration.
My position is that yes, it could, and it's not for this court to determine any one of those hypotheticals necessarily. And that Damarius is the only circuit. The Eighth Circuit is the only circuit that went that far and came to that conclusion. The Second Circuit, the Seventh Circuit, the Ninth Circuit, the Tenth Circuit have all, without any discussion about what could happen or should happen, have merely concluded that because a specific intent element exists within the purported lesser-included offense, it is therefore not a lesser-included offense, period. And so because the majority of circuits support this, the Air Force supports this logic.
The Air Force hemmed and hawed. I think it may be a little strong to say they support it.
Fair, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Captain Dre, is an erroneous LIO determination necessarily clear and obvious error?
I think yes, Your Honor. Under this court's elements test is quite clear. Line up the elements. Is one of the elements necessarily included? And looking at the elements where there is an entire specific intent in this purported lesser-included offense, it clearly and obviously is not a lesser-included offense of the supposed greater.
So is it your position then that we look at whether it's a subset, number one, in terms of the plain error test, that, from your view, would be satisfied here, then it's necessarily, because it's an erroneous LIO determination of you, your viewpoint, it is necessarily clear and obvious. When we get to prejudice, is it defense viewpoint that the very fact that the accused could not have been convicted of an offense for this underlying conduct means that prejudice is found? Or do we have to look at other things to determine prejudice within the record?
I see that my time is up, Your Honor. If I
answer the question.
It's not structural error, for example.
I recognize that this court has not found that this is structural error, yes, that the appellant must prove, show that it materially prejudices rights, and then the prejudice here is that his defense, and this court has noted, in Wilkins, this court noted that there are times when a charging decision, an lesser-included offense of a sexual nature with a specific intent could prejudice an appellant, and this is that case. When you have a single incident of a young girl testifying many years later of a shower, where an additional defense absolutely exists with a crime requiring a specific intent, that is prejudicial to an appellant, to an accused. I'm sorry. Pending further questions.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Major Jeremy Watford, along with Lieutenant Colonel Wayne Williams. I represent the United States. Aggravated sexual contact of a child is a lesser-included offense to rape of a child because the specific intent required for a sexual contact is necessarily included and is always present in the act of penile penetration of the vulva. However, even if this court disagrees, there is no prejudice in this case, where the appellant was clearly on notice that his specific intent was at issue in this trial.
Counsel, on that first point, I believe I just heard the counsel for the appellant say, well, wouldn't necessarily be the case. You could have penetration out of curiosity without any sexual intent. What's the answer to that?
Your Honor, in such a case, I believe the curiosity would be to, phrase another way, to satisfy one's curiosity about sexual arousal or sexual gratification. The government maintains that there is simply no factual scenario in which the government could prove the general intent necessary for the sexual act of penile penetration without also necessarily satisfying the requirements for a sexual contact. And here,
but the statute is a general intent statute.
Yes, Your Honor.
So that wasn't included by Congress or so forth. So what are we to make that? Why shouldn't we stick to elements of the offense and simply say, in our recent opinions, we're using subsets? Essentially, it's a mathematical Venn diagram.
Yes, Your Honor, because as this court has noted in its recent cases on this issue, the statutory language need not be identical. As Your Honor stated in the concurrence in Armstrong.
Well, the language need not be identical, but intent, the difference between specific intent and general intent, there's a difference there.
There is, Your Honor, but
We just read a case on that last week, right?
We did, Your Honor. The government's argument would be that the test is whether or not the elements of that lesser offense are implicitly subsumed into the elements of the greater. And here, as the court stated in McDonald's.
Doesn't that march us straight back into the wild, wild wood of that schmuck got us out of?
No, Your Honor. Here, where the general intent is to commit an act which is inherently sexual. There is simply no other purpose for the act.
That's the assumption. That's the government's assumption going in. But, of course, the burden is on the government. The burden's not on the accused to show that there might be something else. I frankly, why don't, as Judge Olson said, you just stack up the elements and you got this things sticking out here that's not over here. So what do we do?
Your Honor, the elements require some sexual misconduct, whether it's a sexual act or a sexual contact. And a plain reading of the statute shows the purpose of that mens rea is to carve out and make sure that what we are capturing is, in fact, misconduct that is by its nature sexual. As the appellant rightfully shows, there are certain lesser kinds of touching which may only be sexual if there is a concurrent intent.
But, I mean, it might not be sexual in some of those, right? It can be with the intent to abuse, right, or to humiliate, and no sexual intent at all for the LIO.
Yes, Your Honor. When I say sexual intent, and forgive me if I'm being unclear, I'm referring to the entire intent clause that makes it a sexual contact.
So, for example, you say that there can be no reason other than sexual intent. There's a whole body of literature out there that says that rape is not actually a sexual crime, right? It's a crime about violence. What's your response to that? That they don't do it to gratify their sexual desires. They do it to be violent towards their victim.
Absolutely. And again, Your Honor, when I say that there's no way to prove rape without satisfying the intent requirement for a sexual contact, I mean the entirety of that clause. There's no factual situation, nor can the appellate present one, in which the government could prove the offense of rape without necessarily also meeting that requirement.
Is it an affirmative defense? You're treating it like an affirmative defense, and I don't think it is. You're saying, you know, that the appellant can't come up with anything. Does the appellant need to come up with anything?
Your Honor, as this court stated in Wilkins, the question before the court is, if you prove the greater offense, have you necessarily proven the lesser? That is the way in which it is a subset. It is always going to be encompassed and captured by the act of penile penetration of the vulva.
But Congress saw fit to have a specific intent in this other offense, right? And so how have you necessarily proven that by proving that someone penetrated a vulva with a penis?
Because, Your Honor, in any situation where you prove penile penetration of the vulva, that intent is present. It is inseparable from and intrinsic to the act itself. This is a very limited situation where there is no other purpose for the act. It essentially speaks for itself in terms of what the possible purposes for that act are. And that is why we have that separate...
We've come up with a couple right here. Anger, curiosity. How about they hate themselves and they hate sex, and so they're doing it as a penance. I mean, I'm just saying.
Your Honor, I believe in any of those situations, the government still would successfully meet the requirement for sexual contact, that it falls under one of the possibilities there to abuse, humiliate, degrade the person involved. And again, whether it is, as Your Honor describes, a sort of masochistic act, perhaps, that could still be ultimately for the arousal or gratification of the sexual desire.
So if we get back to fundamentals, the issue is notice. So if somebody is charged with a general intent crime, how is there notice that they need to defend against specific intent? If we just, basics here. I mean, if you think of the mens rea as a ladder in terms of going up, how if the general intent is out there, how do you say that an accused knows to defend against a specific intent?
Your Honor, when he's charged with a general intent offense, he wouldn't necessarily be defending against specific intent because, again, for the act of penile penetration of the vulva, there is no other purpose. He's on notice because, in this case, the appellant is charged with penetrating his 3-year-old stepdaughter's vulva with his penis. It is unreasonable, as the appellant now asks this court to believe, that facing that charge, he is somehow wholly unaware that that necessarily means first touching her vulva with a sexual purpose in mind. And that is what the appellant is asking this court to find, is that within the entire rubric of Article 120, penile penetration is somehow the only variety of sexual conduct that does not have a sexual purpose. And again, I use that referring to the entirety of the specific intent clause, that does not have some sexual purpose underlying it. That defies both the structure and the language of the statute, and frankly, it defies common sense.
I'm not asking you to concede the point, but let's say this court were to determine that it was error. So through the plain error analysis, step two, based on our case law, would you say or not say that a mere determination of an erroneous LIO determination necessarily constitutes clear and obvious error?
Your Honor. It does not constitute clear and obvious
error. Could you please address that?
Of course, Your Honor. First of all, as was noted earlier, there's a split both in the federal circuits and in the military service courts. You have the existing manual for courts martial, both in the 2008 version and currently, which still list this as a lesser included offense. The contact offenses fall under the act offenses. And
can you point to, though, our case law? I understand your point there. You've got it listed as an LIO in the manual. You've got service courts out there. So if you were to look at it in terms of clear, obvious error, we would examine those aspects. What can you point to in terms of this court's case law that would lead you to believe that it is not necessarily clear, obvious error?
Your Honor, the government would concede that in the recent cases, at least applying the elements test for plain error, that this court has generally found it to be plain and obvious error. But the government maintains this is a different case
but
than those recent cases.
In most of those cases, wasn't it Article 134, failure to plead terminal elements, right? And we said, but we just said that can't be.
Yes, Your Honor, or in Armstrong, where it was comparing Article 128 and its distinct language from Article 120. The government maintains this is a very different case where, not conceding that there is error at all, if this court does find that it's an erroneous LIO, it certainly was not a plain and obvious error for the military judge in this case to find that the appellant touching his stepdaughter's vulva with his penis was somehow not necessarily included in the charged offense that he penetrated. In fact, it is factually required, Your Honor, for the appellant to have accomplished the greater offense, the factual predicate with which he was charged.
Now you're going back to your first argument, and we've kind of moved on from that, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So let's assume that we disagree with you about the LIO, and let's assume we'll assume that it was plain and obvious error. Talk about why it wasn't prejudice to a substantial rights.
Yes, Your Honor. First of all, again, the appellant's asking this court to believe that just facing the language of the charge, that it did not put him on notice that he had to have first made contact with her vulva with some sexual purpose. The government maintains that that's unreasonable just as a function of notice and what the appellant could read on the face of the charge. Furthermore, as was noted earlier, it's an enumerated lesser-included offense. So a plain reading of the MCM also gives the appellant notice of this. And if that's not enough, Your Honor, the appellant is facing that parallel concurrent charge for a sexual contact offense for the exact same overall incident. So when the appellant walks into court for this trial, he knows that he is charged with sexual abuse requiring that specific intent while he is in the shower with his stepdaughter for the same course of conduct, that at the moment he is alleged to have committed that rape, his sexual intent is at issue, it's something the government's going to have to prove, and it's something he should be prepared to defend against.
What if anything should we make of the fact that once the military judge entered a finding of guilty, found him guilty by exceptions to this other offense, that he didn't say anything, that nothing was said about it, no complaint was made?
I think that absolutely supports the lack of surprise, Your Honor, both that this court should apply plain error because there was no objection at trial, and the fact that this was not a surprise to anyone. There's no request to either move for reconsideration based on the judge's finding or for any exceptions or substitutions. The appellant understood what he had been convicted of.
Counsel, if we find that there was an error and that it was in fact plain error and we actually get to the prejudice prong, what is the standard for the prejudice? Is it material prejudice or harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt, assuming that we got all the other steps first?
Material prejudice, Your Honor, and as this court applied in Armstrong, even noting that it is the constitutional right of notice, this court nevertheless required the appellant to demonstrate material prejudice to his substantial rights.
So why wouldn't material prejudice be examined through the simplest of prisms in terms of, well, if there hadn't been this erroneous LAO, and as I noted, I'm not asking you to concede that the first two prongs of the plain error test are satisfied, but let's say for the sake of the argument they are. Why isn't this simplest notion of, well, if he hadn't, this erroneous LIO hadn't surfaced, he wouldn't have been convicted of any crime for the underlying conduct. That demonstrates that he was prejudiced. That alone, standing alone, shows that he was prejudiced.
I understand your argument, Your Honor, and it's simply not the standard that this court has consistently applied. I think taking Your Honor's position would essentially elevate it into...
I'm not taking a position. I'm asking a question.
I apologize, Your Honor, but under that hypothetical, it would elevate it essentially to structural error, where any conviction for a lesser included offense would per se be invalid. And that is not the standard this court has applied at any point in its jurisprudence reviewing lesser included offenses. Pending any further questions, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Does the appellant have rebuttal?
Your Honor, I'll just start with your question to the government. The idea that this court's current precedent requires a showing of actual material prejudice, perhaps in tactics or preparing for a trial, is this court's precedent. However, this court can change its precedent. This is a structural error is that which causes a person to doubt the integrity of a justice system. And just the very idea.
Let me ask you this. Wouldn't the first person to doubt that integrity be the defense counsel at the trial? I mean, you don't have before us here a claim of ineffectiveness, so aren't we to assume that the defense counsel at trial was competent counsel?
Yes, competent, but there's a lot of other things going on at trial. That trial defense counsel has to sit next to their client who's now exposed to 80 years in confinement.
Right, but at the time of the findings, that was all that was going on, wasn't it? Once they announced the findings, the counsel didn't say anything? I mean, if he was going to be surprised or taken aback or felt he was his client was prejudiced, wouldn't that have been the moment? And it goes back to the question, I think, that Judge Ryan asked.
Perhaps, but again,
doesn't our system also set up where in your 1105 and 1106 matters, you can still bring those to the attention of the convening authority? And he didn't in this case, as I understand, right?
Yes, Your Honor. He did not.
So at what point would he have raised the doubt? Yeah, there's two opportunities there. Does he wait till the appeal comes when a talented lawyer like you gets on the case? Is that when the surprise occurs?
Perhaps, but it's not. But I think that examining this under a rubric of I'm surprised because I didn't expect this to be a lesser included is different than the idea of I'm surprised that this is a different offense that includes a different offense that includes the possibility of an entire landscape of different defenses to it. And so,
goes to the trial preparation and the trial activity, and defense counsel didn't raise any of those issues.
Right, Your Honor, but again, I believe that it is not a matter of whether the trial defense counsel had to object at that time to convey some type of.
I'm not saying he necessarily had to, but it would certainly make a stronger case, given the case that you're making here, would it not?
It would make a stronger case, yes, Your Honor.
Right.
So, counsel, if you were to adopt what seems to be your posture of, first we look at whether it was an erroneous LAO determination, but then the next two prongs of the plain error doctrine fall like dominoes, that, well, you made an erroneous LAO determination, that's automatically clear or obvious error, and the next step clearly was prejudice because he was convicted of an LAO that shouldn't have been out there. Isn't that structural error, even if we use a different name? If everything, all the dominoes fall just based on that initial determination that it was an erroneous LAO.
Yes, and I believe it should be, where you have the government controls the charge sheet entirely. They assumably have been talking to the witnesses and understand what evidence they expect to come out at trial. They prepare everything, and for them to get the advantage of having an uncharged offense available for conviction after the evidence, it is problematic for our system where we have all sorts of different procedural protections for an accused as he's going toward trial, where that the government conveniently can avoid then with this type of finding where it's not going to a preliminary hearing and there are not those types of protections. And so perhaps plain error review doesn't work in this context where it's a charge. I think there's improper referral issues. There's jurisdictional issues with a charge that has not been adequately pled in the charging document, where this is a notice pleading jurisdiction that Fossler makes very clear that an appellant should be on notice of everything against which he must defend in the charging document itself, and where not, it is not unreasonable for this court to determine that it is structural error, that we have lots of questions and concerns about how people perceive the military justice system when people are being convicted of offenses they weren't charged with. Because while the facts of this offense may be close, if you take this analysis to its logical extremes, what stops the government from charging someone with a robbery and then convicting him of a murder if this type of analysis, if a prejudice analysis is the one that this court will use? I don't see what stops that if the government can always say, well, it wasn't clear. It was error, but it wasn't clear, and you know there's no prejudice because this guy should have seen it coming. So pending any further questions, I ask this court to dismiss specification two of charge, specification one of charge two.
Thank you, counsel. Court thanks counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted. Court will be in recess until 10:20.